Bob, you raised some fascinating issues in this scenario that we'll look into in depth. But the one that intrigues me from the start is the fact that this guy started out with a real good weather brief. He was really ready to go and made some very, very good preparations and had a good plan based upon the forecast. But as is the case with weather, what is forecast is not always what is. And how do we prepare ourselves for the actual, you know, when all we have at the start of our flight is the forecast, which in this case was looking pretty good.
Forecast wasn't looking bad at all for this flight, but a forecast is a forecast. It does not give you actual conditions, or it is not going to definitively indicate what's going to happen en route. So you have to remember, forecasts may be indicative of what the trend will be, but precisely what kind of actual weather you'll experience, well, nobody knows that. That coupled with this pilot's lack of understanding of his equipment and not recognizing that his next rad wasn't receiving initially brought him into this problem. So what you want to watch out for here in terms of these XM devices is that you're receiving your weather on a regular schedule. You can monitor the signal strength on these devices if you go to the XM page and take a look at what your signal strength is. Certainly, you don't want to cover up your antenna. And if you find when you're monitoring signal strength that you have less than a maximum signal, you might want to try to reposition the XM antenna on your glare shield. Sometimes, particularly if you're heading north, you might have to do this because the satellite sits somewhere in the southern sky. And sometimes this can affect your download rate. If you're getting less than maximum signal strength, you may experience some lapses in updates. That's been my experience with the XM devices.
I've seen up to a 30-minute delay, Bob, without anything on the glare shield covering the antenna. And, of course, you always get those delays when you really want the information.
Exactly. I found that they tend to be more frequent on that north heading, depending on the aircraft and what kind of exposure that antenna has to the southern sky will affect the download rate.
I hadn't thought about that, but my experience was on a northbound flight, so you're correct.
And isn't it interesting here, because you spent a great deal of time in your discussion talking about the limits, the physical limits on the equipment and the delays that are built in. But here, this pilot was clever enough to introduce his own delay into the system by blocking his antenna. How could he have dealt with that mistake a lot quicker than he did? Because, boy, unfortunately, you know, he compounded the scenario of the deteriorating weather by eliminating the source of feedback. And, boy, being a little bit more aggressive, a little bit more proactive there, he could have helped himself out a lot.
Well, to some extent, the root cause here is a cockpit organization issue. The glare shield is not a place to store stuff. A number of problems occur there, to include affecting your magnetic compass, to include on some airplanes stuff slipping down behind the glare shield, between the windshield and the glare shield. It's not a good place to store your various materials in the cockpit.
Not to mention it's going to reduce your ability to see traffic as well. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
I've phoned with countless people that you even think about putting something on the glare shield, you're going to get your hand smacked. And I think that's a good point for our listener today to really pay attention to that, because even temporarily, you know, we'll put keys, we'll put pens, we'll put pieces of paper. Well, I mean, it's just a very convenient place to put stuff down. And in a busy cockpit, which they all are definitionally, you know, we're always looking for a spot. So I think it's a good point right now, and we talked about this earlier, that the glare shield is never, even for a short period of time, a good place to put anything. And it can avoid an awful lot of problems, including the one that we're looking at here today, by just never putting anything on the glare shield, even for a short period of time, that doesn't belong there.
With regard to the XM antenna, some of the very first ones had a magnet in the back of them. Mm-hmm. Which was designed, I think, for the boating business to hold the puck on the boat. That certainly is another issue as to where you place that XM antenna. You don't want to get it anywhere near your magnetic compass unless you are certain that yours doesn't have a magnet in the back of it.
And isn't it amazing, Bob? This pilot, like all of us on different occasions, kind of got drawn into this thing because he's looking at his equipment. His equipment is telling him what he wants to hear, what he expects to hear. But he's looking out the window, and he's got a difference between what he sees and what he's expecting. And what are we supposed to do as pilots when we see a difference between two sources of information?
Well, one thing to remember as a pilot, if it doesn't seem right, it's probably not right. So you need to go back and find out why there's a difference between what you're seeing and what was indicated in this case on the handheld device that was displaying the radar images.
And once again, once you start seeing this difference, boy, that might cause you to look at the time, the valid time on your display, and then all of a sudden you've resolved the conflict. Because like any other computer, we are human beings, our computers. We just can take this from a conflict and just remove it from our table and put it up back on the back burner where it belongs, as opposed to something that has us confused and is occupying, you know, more of our time and data capability than we need.
That timestamp on the next red image should have been in this pilot's scan, along with any other key instruments on the airplane. He was depending on this particular device to establish that his route was clear, but he wasn't checking to determine whether the device was actually working or not.
And another instant device we have at our disposal, you know, when we start looking out the window and things start looking a little different than what we expect, our good friends at ATC, we ask the question, hey, do you have any PIREPs up ahead? And boy, I'll tell you, when I've done in-route cockpit evaluations with the airlines, that's one thing the pilot is always doing. He's always asking ATC, what are the pilots up ahead reporting? Okay, you're going from forecast weather to actual weather, and isn't that what we really want, Wally? What is actually occurring in front of me down the road?
Absolutely, and of course, ATC's got a handle on that with what they can see on their scope and what they're hearing from the pilots. But the other part of that is we've got some eyeballs that also can tell us an awful lot. And no matter what the picture on the screen is, if it doesn't look right out ahead, you better take some action and not go there.
And John, with regard to ATC, pilots working with ATC, what a delicate balance. And it's a wonderful tool, but once again, ATC is not there specifically to keep us out of bad weather. And yes, they can help us as a tool, but they have other stuff to do. So let's talk a little bit about how we best use ATC without abusing them or, you know, helping the system to break down by an overdependency upon ATC.
Sure. Well, you have to understand, first of all, the limitations, the physical limitations. We touched on it a bit in this scenario, the physical limitations of the radar systems that they're using. There are differences between the en route systems and the terminal systems. Terminal systems provide a bit more real-time weather. But then there's also the individual controller's ability to interpret the weather, and then there's a wide variety there. Some controllers will go a little further than others in assisting a pilot based upon the capabilities that they have to display. The controller is required by the handbook, the 71-10-65, to provide weather advisories as a first priority. There's several levels of priority in safety alerts, weather, traffic alerts. Those are all first priority duties. And in this case, the controller did provide the weather advisory, which was basically, I'm seeing this huge area of weather in front of you. Deviations approved. Let me know what you want to do. The controller satisfied the legal requirement. The level of assistance that goes beyond that, though, may or may not be within the controller's ability. If there's no way to vector you through or around this weather, given a sufficient berth for the time lag and limitations in it, there just may be no way to vector you around it. But a couple of things that you do have to do with your interactions with ATC, you know, first is ask them right away. As you said, you want to start asking questions when you're 40 or 50 miles away rather than 5 miles away and you're now in a blind canyon. And make sure the controller understands exactly what you want. Just to say the generic thing, well, I need a heading to get me out of this. You know, you got to work a little bit. How does it look to the southeast, or how does it look to the west, or will a 150 heading get me out of this, or something specific? You got to make sure that you both understand exactly what you're able to do. Understand also that the controller could be very well task saturated at this point. If you're not the only airplane that's encountering the weather, a center controller, they have a fairly large sector of responsibility. Cleveland Center, in this case, is working at, they may be working up to 17,000 feet in a 200 or 300 square mile area. The thunderstorms are all over it, so everybody's looking for the same thing. So you really have to understand exactly what the limitations are and how to work with the controller best.
John, I like your analogy of the canyon. You know, yeah. We all have a tremendous respect for rocks, especially big rocks that are in front of us or on either side of us. But how many of us think about a thunderstorm that way? And Wally, isn't that a really a valid way of looking at a thunderstorm? I mean, you know, they're not rocks, but they're as nasty as rocks, aren't they?
They can be just as nasty as rocks, for sure. Extreme turbulence, they can take wings off of airplanes. They can take airplanes apart. You can encounter hail, updrafts and downdrafts that are way beyond the capability of the airplane or the pilot.
That's where the term cumulogranite comes from.
But the fact of the matter is, and I know talking with far too many pilots, you know, who tell you their hairy thunderstorm stories, and nobody will ever do it twice, but the problem is you may not get that second chance, you know, based upon what Wally's talking about here. But do we really respect, I mean, do we understand the nature of thunderstorms, the awesome power that they contain, and the various stages? I mean, when they're forming, when they're dissipating, and the incredibly broad spectrum that they involved. I mean, they can encompass literally hundreds of miles. They can be isolated, you know, right over an airport. But all of these different components affect us in a different way. I know for a fact that people really don't spend the time to understand the nature of thunderstorms. And if they did, I think they would have a better respect for them and, you know, would avoid them, would spend a lot more aggressive behavior avoiding them than dealing with them too late in the event.
I think there's also the tendency for some people to have maybe made a little brush with one or a little skirt with it and said, ah, that's no big deal. I flew next to a thunderstorm and I was 3 miles away from it and I was fine. And they get kind of bold about it. So one day you fly next to a thunderstorm and you're 3 miles away and you were totally in the clear. Next time you do it, you can't see. You're embedded. It's night. And it becomes a very, very different scenario. And you don't have the respect for it. And you kind of get insulated almost from that respect or very casual because you've managed to successfully avoid this a couple of times.
Night really complicates the issue. I can tell you from my experience, even with onboard radar, which is real-time thunderstorm information, the eyeballs were the thing I used to stay out of the bad stuff. I've encountered moderate to severe clear air turbulence 20 miles from a thunderstorm deviating around it on the upwind side.
You may be operating below the anvil of a thunderstorm, which is 20,000 feet above you, so you're oblivious to the fact that this anvil is above you, and it may be depositing softball-sized hail upon your airplane. So the anvils are important. These gust fronts, these downdrafts associated with thunderstorms, and they're not all visible.
And the wind shear that's associated with thunderstorms that are close up to an airport in your takeoff and landing stages, this can affect even large aircraft. We're not talking about hazards to small aircraft, but hazards to all aircraft.
And remember, you're the pilot in command of your airplane. If you see something out there that is not going to be comfortable for you, regardless of what the controller has said or regardless of what your clearance is, you have that emergency authority to deviate and do what's necessary to stay out of it. So just because a controller cleared you through it doesn't mean it's clear. We talked earlier about that their information can also be old or they can be distracted with other duties.
So. Sure. And a couple of high-profile accidents, you know, really pointed out to us how incredibly powerful these storms can be. I mean, to take an L-1011 and slam it into the ground, you know, with the pilots doing everything on board to deal with that. And if it does that to an airplane that is that powerful and that large, you know, what is it going to do to a general aviation airplane? It's going to be tossed around like a feather in a windstorm. And that's the kind of thing that we have to deal with and might have to deal with, you know, if we're not paying attention. Another thing that is very, very helpful that most general aviation pilots don't have access to is some of the simulator training we've seen. Wally, I know you've done it as I have, where we've had to fly through some of these storm fronts, these gust fronts on approach to landing. And one thing you learn is not to fly through it. You learn to get the heck out of it.
Go around early.
Absolutely.
Get
because it's
it.
Not about flying through it. It's about getting out of it and absolutely getting out of the area.
Yep.
And if you don't do it early, you're not going to do it.
And often you might be looking out the window seeing the runway, but the gust front is coming across the airport. And if you try to land in that, you're going to be in big trouble. Whereas the go around 5 miles out, even though you see the airport, is the right thing to do.
Another point that I think is relevant with all this is the timeliness of a weather decision. Making an early weather decision gives you a long list of options. The farther you wait into this, it's like the canyon scenario, John. Your options are very, very limited. And at that point, you know, it may be, you know, what we call too late.
And that's the strategic element of it. And that's really what these Datalink weather systems or weather devices were designed for, to give you the big picture so that you can look at this when you're 100 miles away and make the decision at that point a 20-degree turn at 100 miles away can take you well clear of it. Or maybe that's time to land then and reassess the situation rather than try to tactically pick your way through it.
Don't forget that you always have the 180-degree turn option.
Right.
And I know we hear stories about pilots saying that the weather built behind them or came closed in behind them. I suppose in some extreme cases of summertime building, as you mentioned, Bob, that could happen. But that's a pretty rare event. If you have been in good weather and you're flying into bad weather, do that 180 and go back where you were.
Generally, it's a line rather than pop-ups.
Yeah, unless you've been flying in the canyon for a while, Bob, as you said. Then you might get in trouble.
And how many pilots have specific avoidance criteria in the back of their mind? Do you think most people do that? I know, Wally, at your airline, and I know in the military, we had very specific guidance by which you would avoid thunderstorms from. And I think it's a good starting point. And they are minimums, just like all our other minimums. You can always extend them if you want to, and as you should do, based upon your level of experience and the information you have available to you. But having some good avoidance criteria. I'm never going to be closer than 10 miles, for instance, to a thunderstorm, or maybe 20 is even better. 10 miles from a thunderstorm, bad stuff is still going on. So you don't even want to get close to a thunderstorm.
One of our numbers, Bob, was 20 miles, minimum of 20 miles above 25,000 feet. That means if you want to go between two thunderstorms, that hole has to be 40 miles wide. And as you pointed out, that was a minimum. It was up to the captain whether he or she chose to do that.
And the other thing is sucker holes, okay? You say it looks good. There's an opening, and we all get, visually you can, get brought into a sucker hole. Well, you can also, by technology, be brought into a sucker hole. And next thing you know, what you're really looking at is 20 miles down the road, and there you are. You've gotten through this soft spot only to hit the hard spot. And then, once again, you're up the creek without the paddle.
And I did want to mention, you had talked earlier, Bob, about PIREPs from ATC. You do have to use those with a lot of caution in a situation like this when you're picking your way through weather or trying to use it, because an airplane may have flown through that area 10 minutes before and reported a smooth ride. But in that 10 minutes, it's built up and developed enough that that hole is now closed or the cell has moved closer to your route of flight or whatever. 10 minutes can make a big, big difference in whether a particular area is safe to transit or not.
Tremendous discussion in aviation now about technology. Is it helping us? Is it hurting us? With regard to weather, are we doing a better job with the technology we have, or are we setting ourselves up for scenarios like this?
I think for a pilot who knows how to use the equipment, it gives him a broader picture of what's going on around him in terms of the weather. But you need to know how to use the equipment. You need to know how to use the device that you're working with in terms of customizing the representations on the screen. You need to learn how to declutter your screen. If you're operating IFR, there's not much need to have airspace displayed on the screen. Likewise, various devices have various levels of declutter, and you can take out nav aids and other things that are cluttering the screen. Generally, you're working with a relatively small screen. You need to learn how to clean it up. That includes cloud cover on devices that will display cloud cover. Not something you're particularly interested in if you're flying IFR. So you might want to take that off the screen. Learn how to do that in the setup mode to clean up your screen. And on some devices, you can set them so cloud cover only appears on certain ranges, generally the out ranges. The near ranges, you keep clean of cloud cover. It can improve the utility and allow you a better opportunity to interpret the data that's shown by eliminating congestion and confusion.
One other point I'd like to put on the table, and that is, as pilots, we're risk managers. Everybody has a different risk tolerance. So I think thunderstorms is probably, if it's not number one, it's number two on the list for things that, hey, wait a minute, do I really want to fly this day based upon the fact that thunderstorms are a possibility? Because thunderstorms not only can make you uncomfortable, they can make you nervous, but they can also kill you, as we've talked about here, and have done based upon stepping over that line. So I think as you look at your flight and you ask yourself, do I go today? Do I go at all? You as a decision maker need to evaluate the risk tolerance and just how comfortable you are if thunderstorms are even in the forecast.
This pilot made a good decision to attempt to leave early, to land early. I read somewhere that if you land before 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you'll miss 80% of the thunderstorms. Unfortunately, it didn't work out for this pilot, which proves that none of these rules are 100% true.
That's right. Well, there's a 20% there that you're not going to avoid.
But planning your flight to land before 2 o'clock in the afternoon is one way to miss a big bunch of these guys.
And we talked about, after dark, it really gets complex, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And getting back to the display, the NextRad weather display, remember that's not heading reference. So if you've got a 15 or 20 degree wind correction angle to fly the route that you're flying, that's not going to tie with what you see on the NextRad display. You need to consider that. There's no heading reference built in there. So give you a little bit of confusion in terms of what you see out in front of you versus what's on the NextRad display.
And take into account the effect that the winds will have on your ground speed, too, into this. On a 110-knot Cessna, 20 or 30 knots makes a big difference, whether you're trying to go into the wind or tailwind.
Good point. Good point. Moderate winds aloft will have a big effect on an airplane going 100 knots.
Yeah.
Bob, I'd like to go back to your technology comment of a couple of minutes ago. Certainly the modern technology is great. It gives us an awareness of what's out there. But we all have to be aware of the limitations of that technology. And all of these products that we're talking about, NextRad and all these on-screen displays, tell us that they're not for tactical navigation around thunderstorms. Yet we see pilots using them for just that and getting in trouble.